Chaitanya Dina Kasna Sri Guru Dhanima Sri Chaitanya Manavistam Stapisham Dina Vitale Sayam Upakadam Hemda Dati Sapananti Kam Vansa Kaupatu Vyascha Kripa Sindhu Vaya Vyasat Titan Kada Yudhu Vyasa Sri Guru Dhanima Now, in the previous chapter, the fourth chapter, which we have just completed, Krishna has glorified transcendental knowledge. The title of this chapter, the fourth chapter, is Transcendental Knowledge. He's described jhan as being able to burn all reactions to material activities, all karma. The results of all karma gets burned to ashes, just like a fire burns firewood to ashes. This is the power of jnana or knowledge. And nothing is so sublime and pure as transcendental knowledge, as jnana. And if someone practices this, he enjoys this knowledge within himself in due course of time. There is nothing so sublime and pure as transcendental knowledge. A faithful man who is dedicated to transcendental knowledge and who subdues his senses is eligible to achieve such knowledge, and having achieved it, he quickly attains the supreme spiritual peace. So what is this practice of knowledge? Knowledge is so glorified in the process of getting jnana is jnana yoga. And jnana yoga means controlling the senses, stopping activities, and basically focusing the consciousness within. But then Krishna ends the same chapter after glorifying jnana so much, being introspectively thoughtful and getting knowledge. He ends the chapter by saying, slash the doubts that have arisen in your heart out of ignorance. They should be slashed by the weapon of knowledge. Again, knowledge is glorified. And then, armed with this yoga, O Bharata, stand and fight. So Krishna, from Arjuna's perspective, is telling him two opposite things. That I should get knowledge, which entails not engaging in activities of the world, which are performed for fruitive motives. I should get knowledge, I should be introspective, I should meditate, I should contemplate. But how at the same time can I do that and be engaged in fighting, in a war, as an archer? That's going to entangle me in so many activities. So this is the same, basically the same question Arjuna asks in chapter 3. And Krishna begins to answer this by explaining how knowledge, and also Krishna has also said, so Arjuna is confused basically. So Arjuna says, O Krishna, first you asked me to renounce work, engage in jnana, sannyasa karmanam Krishna, and then again you recommend work with devotion, you recommend yoga, you recommend them fight. I said, fight. Now tell me, kindly tell me, definitely, which of the two is more beneficial? What should I do? Should I not work to attain knowledge, or should I fight? Because Krishna seems to have said both. And what Krishna, of course, wants Arjuna to do is combine the two things, not keep them in opposition to each other, but to work on the platform of knowledge. So Prabhupada asked the question, he says, he appears not to have understood that work in full knowledge is non-reactive. So Krishna has explained this already about akarma. Earlier on in chapter 4, akarma being not work, but non-reactive work, work that doesn't have fruitive reactions. So he thinks that work and renunciation appear to him to be incompatible, because actions will bring reactions. He appears not to have understood that work in full knowledge is non-reactive and is therefore the same as inaction. So the same result of not getting any result comes from spiritual work, work on the platform of knowledge, of transcendental knowledge, as you don't get any reaction, as if you didn't do anything, because you're doing something as a servant, you're acting as a servant. He inquires, therefore, whether he should cease work altogether or work with full knowledge. And the answer, of course, is going to be from Krishna, to say, to work in full knowledge. So Krishna begins his reply in text 2. The renunciation in work, and work in devotion, or work in full knowledge, devotion meaning the highest knowledge, are both good for liberation. Liberation means freedom from bondage. So to act with devotion means you're acting on the akarma level. There are no reactions. And if you perform jnana yoga or sankhya yoga and cease to perform any activity, you're also not getting any reaction. So they're the same level and both purify you. But of the two, working with devotion and renunciation of work, fully meditating on oneself as a soul and extricating oneself from material activities. But of the two, work in devotion or work is yoga, karma yoga, vishishyate, karma, that work in devotion is superior, is better than the renunciation of work. Vishishyate means it's better. Work in devotion or karma yoga is better than the renunciation of work. Now why? One who neither hates nor desires the fruits of his actions, desires the fruits of his activities, just working dutifully, is known to be always renounced. He is sannyasi, nitya sannyasi. So what makes one nitya sannyasi? One who neither hates nor desires the fruits of his activities. In other words, he's working, but not working to gain any fruit, any result. He's working. Why? Because it's his duty. This is karma yoga, detached work. He is said one to be a nitya sannyasi. He is always a renouncer. He is always renounced. Such a person, free from all dualities, because the dualities are what bind us to the material world. Icha, dvesha, samutena. Dvanva mohena bharata, they bewilder us. We want this, we don't want that, and we let what our icha and dvesha, our desires and our aversions, we let them dictate, push us completely around and force us to act and force us to not act. So when one just acts without any desire for the fruit, that's a deeper type of renunciation. Such a person, free from all dualities, easily overcomes material bondage and is completely liberated, O mighty Arjuna. So why does he overcome bondage? Because this is what binds everyone. This is what's forcing one, whipping one into action. I want this, I don't want this. No one does anything without wanting something from it. So when one doesn't want anything from one's work, one is liberated from those pushings. It doesn't require to renounce work, it requires to renounce the fruit of one's work. It's even deeper than renouncing one's work. It's even more advanced than renouncing one's work, because it's internal. Because the problem, if we renounce externally, we don't work. But the problem is that internally we're still attached. So the real essence is the internal detachment. So Krishna is making this division. Be internally renounced, not externally renounced.
Because again, it's easy to fool oneself and others if we are externally renounced. We can make a show of renunciation, be internally attached, and get ourselves later into so much trouble. And cheat others too.
So such a person, free from all dualities, in other words, free from being controlled by the dualities of material life, I want this, I don't want this, it's a dvesha, he easily overcomes material bondage. And he's completely liberated. Why? Because what does liberated mean? It means free. So he's free from being controlled by the external dualities of life. So he's explaining, Krishna explaining, how to become liberated while working. Because it's so difficult, so he's going to explain this already, that we can't even, you can't even maintain your body without working. You have to do something. So how to work in such a way? This is the puzzle that Krishna is solving. How to work in such a way that you don't become entangled. There's the karmi, or the materialistic person who performs his karma or work to gain something from the material world, and he's trapped by it. Rather than exploiting the material world, he's trapped by it. So the jnani has knowledge. You know, I don't want to be trapped by the material world, because the material world means I think it's going to be pleasure giving, but it's suffering giving. It gives suffering. It is a palace of tears. So there's the puzzle. And the soul by nature is active. So you have to work. You can't really renounce work. And yet if you work, you become entangled in the dualities and the reactions. So how to be in this world and not be in the world simultaneously? And Krishna is explaining how to do that. And he's explaining in text 4, only the ignorant speak of devotional service or karma yoga as being different from the analytical study of the material world, Sankhya. In other words, the detachment in devotional service or karma yoga is internal, and therefore there are no reactions, so therefore it's the same result of having no reactions comes to one who performs karma yoga properly and also who gives up work. No reactions come. Those who are actually learned, who know what is what, who see deeply, say that he who applies himself well to one of these paths achieves the results of both. What is the result? Freedom from material entanglement. Now when we take this point and apply it to devotional service, working not controlled by one's own likes and dislikes, but controlled by what Krishna likes and what Krishna dislikes, when one loves Krishna so much and allows his consciousness to be dictated, controlled by that consideration, what's pleasing to Krishna, when the motive to please Krishna comes from external shastra says you should do this because Krishna likes it. So that's one level of devotion. And then when one spontaneously loves Krishna and wants to please him, that's still another level of devotion. When the impelling, the force that makes one want to please Krishna is coming from one's own natural attraction to Krishna, that's a still higher level of consciousness. But yet, only the ignorant speak of devotional service as being different from the analytical study of the material world. In other words, both bring no reactions. Those who actually learn it say that he who applies himself well to one of these paths achieves the result of both. One achieves the same result as the other. One who knows that the position reached by means of analytical study can also be attained by devotional service, and who therefore sees analytical study and devotional service to be on the same level, sees things as they are. That is Prabhupada's purport. The real purpose of philosophical research, did you study philosophy in the university?
No, but I have interest to read philosophy.
Right. Did you study philosophy in the university?
Okay. Yeah, because
all I want to know is if you studied in the university.
Not in the university.
Okay. Did you study philosophy in the university?
I'm in history.
I didn't know you were in the university.
Okay.
Huh?
Not yet.
So how could you study philosophy in the university if you're not in the university?
In school.
Okay. Did you study philosophy in the university?
Did you?
One unit.
One unit. So what is the goal? What did they tell you the goal of your philosophical study was in your one unit?
It was philosophy of the history of biology or something like that.
Philosophy of the history. So what was the goal? What was the goal of that one unit study?
I can't remember, man. I think I almost failed. It was like a D or something.
Everyone wants to tell a big story. Do you know what the goal was?
I can't remember.
Did they teach you that it had a goal?
To understand something.
That's deep. The real purpose of philosophical research, when one applies one's mind to philosophy, what's the purpose of it? You want to find out? You want to find out? If you listen carefully, you will know. And you will never again say that I don't know. The real purpose of philosophical research is to find the ultimate goal of life. Did they teach you that in the philosophy of history?
Science is the same thing. Science is almost the same thing.
That is to find the ultimate goal of life?
Science of self-realization is also the philosophy.
Did you take science in the university?
Yes.
Okay, very good. Very good. Did they teach you that what the ultimate goal of life is?
No.
No. I didn't think so. Did they talk about that even?
Yes, sometimes.
What did they say when they talked about it?
They say about this Darwin and the theory of the evolution. I say that it's crap.
Okay. But what did they tell you when they said the ultimate goal of life and it has to do with Darwin? What did they say what the goal of life was?
Goal of life.
No, that's what I thought. They didn't teach you the goal of life. Right. And since no one taught you, do you know what the goal of life is?
From the university's point of view, I don't know.
Okay.
But
for your own personal point of view, do you know what the goal of life is?
Yes.
How did you find out?
From you.
Not from me. I'm just reading the book.
Yeah.
Did you know before?
From the scriptures.
Well, no, I'm asking you really, how did you know the goal of life?
I just read.
What did you read?
The Bhagavad Gita.
What is the goal of life that you have found out?
The goal of life is to go back to Godhead.
And what does that mean to you? What is your understanding of what
it's
that means?
To realize that we are the part and parcel of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and we actually belong to Him.
Yes.
We have to realize that we are not this body, we are a soul, which is the fragment of the Supreme Soul,
yes.
The Supreme Lord Krishna.
And we have a relationship with Him, eternal. And what is that eternal relationship?
Eternal we are meant to please Krishna.
Yes, eternally.
Eternally.
Yes. you get PhD.
I know.
Since the ultimate goal of life is self-realization, there's no difference between the conclusions reached by the two processes. So self-realization is just what you said. To realize what oneself is, and oneself is eternal. Do you feel like you're eternal, or do you feel like you're your body, right in this minute?
Right now.
After a hard day at work, what do you feel like?
Yes. See, right now I'm not on that.
Okay. I'm just asking. What is your?
I'm.
What do you right now? Do you think you are your body, or do you think you are your mind, or do you think you are an eternal servant of Krishna, right now?
Right now.
That's a simple, honest.
The honest answer is, I feel I am my mind.
Okay. So what? Who are you then, right now? I'm my mind.
I'm the mind.
So what is your mind now?
Right now, my mind is to listen to you. So what I just want to.
So therefore, your mind is being very good right now, because it's having you hear Bhagavad Gita. So, and hearing Bhagavad Gita is shravanam, and that is bhakti. It is hearing and is devotional service. So your mind is your very good friend. It's true. But right this minute it is your very good friend. But you can't trust this kind of a friend though. Sometimes they'll pick your pocket also. But for right now, you say, very good mind, you are being my friend. Because it's true, because you didn't have to come tonight. You could have gone, some of your friends, other friends, I mean not real friends, but they're doing all kinds of things tonight, yes? Some of them not so good. So you could have also done that, but your mind said, no, I want to hear Bhagavad Gita and learn who I am eternally. Very good. By Sankhya philosophical research, one comes to the conclusion that a living entity is not a part and parcel of the material world, but of the Supreme Spirit whole. Mm-hmm. By Sankhya. Consequently, the spirit soul has nothing to do with the material world. His actions must be in some relation with the Supreme. When he acts in Krishna consciousness, he's actually in his constitutional position. In the first process, Sankhya, one has to become detached from matter. And in the devotional yoga process, one has to attach himself to the work of Krishna consciousness. So what does that mean? One has to attach himself to the work of Krishna consciousness. What does that mean? What is the work of Krishna consciousness?
Krishna.
Okay, so what does it mean to attach oneself to pleasing Krishna then?
To identify with what Krishna wants.
Yeah, but okay, what kind of realization will make you attached to pleasing Krishna?
If he makes you happy as well.
And if he doesn't make you happy, then forget him?
No, I mean that being attached to Krishna.
But what does it mean to work for Krishna's, what does it mean to work for someone's pleasure? But what realization does the person who's working in that consciousness have? Do you sometimes work for the pleasure of your mother? So what consciousness do you have that makes you work for the pleasure of your mother? Yeah, I think so. Just natural, huh?
Just that we actually belong to her. So
but okay, but what kind? But what consciousness do you have that makes you feel in that way? When you think about your mother, she's thinking, "Oh, he belongs to me for sure." She is thinking that. But what are you thinking?
I also think that I belong to her.
Why?
Because she gave birth to me.
She gave birth to you. She took care of you.
She has done everything.
She fed you, and if it wasn't for her, you'd die. She took care of you, and you feel grateful. And she's always trying to please you, and she still feeds you, and she's always concerned about you. And naturally, with all that affection that she's given you, love she's given you, you naturally love her too. It's, yes? So, in the devotional yoga process, bhakti, one has to attach himself to the work of Krishna consciousness. That means that one has to learn to love Krishna. One's attached to the work of Krishna consciousness because one becomes attached to Krishna and pleasing him. Factually, both processes are the same. Although superficially, one process appears to involve detachment and the other process appears to involve attachment. So Krishna consciousness means to become attached to Krishna, and therefore you're attached to pleasing him. Attached to him means loving affection for him, and therefore you want to please him. Then the wanting to please him is natural. And then you automatically don't want to deal with material things because you want to deal with pleasing Krishna. So in the Sankhya process, you want to not deal with, you're just thinking about, I don't want to deal with material things. 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 So what are you always thinking about? No, in the Sankhya process.
Material things.
Yeah, I don't want to deal with material things. I don't want to go to the movies. 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 What are you always thinking about?
Movies.
But if you're doing something better, then you're not thinking about movies because your mind is absorbed in the better thing. So that's the difference between Krishna consciousness and the Jnana Yoga processes. One is thinking about the positive and one is trying to not do the negative. Is that clear? So therefore, it's clear which one is more powerful. And if you're doing the, and if you're attached to the positive, if you have genuine, true attachment to the positive, the renunciation of the negative happens quite naturally and automatically. Yes? Clear? Detachment from matter and attachment to Krishna are one and the same on one level. In other words, the result of attachment to Krishna, to the spiritual, is detachment from matter, and the result of detachment from matter is detachment from matter. So on that level, they're the same, but yet the attachment to the spiritual, to Krishna, is still superior. It's more powerful. And it also gives a positive result. One who can see this sees things as they are. Krishna continues. Merely renouncing all activities, yet not engaging in the devotional service of the Lord cannot make one happy. That's that same point. Just try to sit in a room and not do anything, because you don't want to do anything that's going to entangle you in material activities. So you decide you're not going to do anything. So you sit in the room and not do anything. That's called prison. No one likes that. It's torture. You just want to go out and do anything if you're caught like that. So therefore, because you're not happy, you're not getting anything positive, and your mind is dwelling, thinking about all the things that you can't do, shouldn't do, don't want to do. So merely renouncing all activities, yet not engaging in the devotional service of the Lord, cannot make one happy. But a thoughtful person engaged in devotional service can achieve the supreme without delay. In other words, if he is deep. So this is the powerful way to do it, to be renounced. So now there's going to be some stages of advancement. One who works in devotion, who is a pure soul, who controls his mind and senses, is dear to everyone, and everyone is dear to him. Though always working, such a man is never entangled. One who works in devotion, so the Sanskrit here is Yukti Yoga Vishuddhatma Vishatma Vitendriya Sava Bhutatma Bhutatma Kovan Apna Lipyate. One who works in devotion, who is a pure soul, who controls his mind and senses, is dear to everyone. And everyone is dear to him. But always working, such a man is never entangled. We'll read from the halfway, two-thirds way down the purport. One may ask, why then was Arjuna offensive to others? If it says that one, because Arjuna was acting in devotion, he was purely surrendering to Krishna, he controlled his mind. So such a person is dear to everyone. But look at Arjuna, he's going to be shooting people with arrows. Is he going to feel dear to him, them? And are they going to feel that, oh, Arjuna is so kind to me, he just chopped off my arm with an arrow? So how can we say that Arjuna is fulfilling Krishna's point over here? So one may ask, why then was Arjuna offensive in battle to others? Wasn't he in Krishna consciousness? Arjuna was only superficially offensive because, as has already been explained in the second chapter, all the assembled persons on the battlefield would continue to live individually, as the soul cannot be slain. So spiritually, no one was killed on the battlefield of Kurukshetra. Only their dresses were changed by the order of Krishna, who was personally present. Therefore, Arjuna, while fighting on the battlefield of Kurukshetra, was not really fighting at all. He was simply carrying out the orders of Krishna in full Krishna consciousness. And such a person is never entangled in the reactions of work. So this is a very deep realization. So easy to say. Although fighting, he was not actually fighting at all. He wasn't killing. And this is the level that Krishna began speaking of in the second chapter. Arjuna was lamenting for all his relatives, and Krishna said, no, you can't kill them because they're eternal. It's just a different level of thinking, just a thoughtful, deep level of thinking. And Arjuna wasn't fighting on one level of thinking, he certainly was fighting. But on another level, he was just simply doing what Krishna said. He was just serving Krishna. He was just trying to please Krishna. And therefore, he wasn't entangled at all in the reactions to his work. This is very, very pure consciousness. Such a person is never entangled in the reactions of work. Arjuna didn't want to take any percentage at all from the work he was doing. He was just simply doing it for Krishna's pleasure. For himself, he didn't have any desire to fight. He didn't want a kingdom. He didn't want this. He didn't want that. He was ready to just walk away. But when he was convinced by Krishna that it was Krishna's desire that this battle take place, and he wanted Arjuna to be his instrument, then he surrendered and fought. And when he fought with all the power he had. But it was simply because Krishna ordered him. There was no desire or aversion on his part. So such a person's consciousness, such a realized person's consciousness, doesn't identify with the body as himself. He identifies himself as simply being a servant of Krishna, an eternal servant of Krishna, Nityadas. And he perceives that Krishna is working through him. So he's not doing the work. And everyone says, oh, Arjuna, you're fighting so well. And Arjuna maybe says, but inside he says, I'm not the one fighting, actually. Krishna's Shakti, Krishna's power
is doing everything. His direction, his power, it's he who's doing it. When someone is in Vrindavan, if someone's cooking for the deities and they cook very wonderfully, and you say, boy, that prasadam was so nice, what do they say? What do they say?
And they say Krishna Bhagavan.
No.
Radharani.
Radharani cooked. I was just assisting. So that's it's when they say Radharani cooked, so that's the most exalted thing if Radharani's cooking. And that's the goal of Krishna consciousness, if Radharani is cooking and you're assisting. But it's not cheap. I mean, because usually I'm cooking and thinking how good it's going to taste after, and I can't wait. And I want something. But this is some, this consciousness that Krishna's explaining to Arjuna is so wonderful, it's exalted, it's elevated, and it's brought to its perfection in Sri Vrindavan Dham. So Krishna's going now to explain how incredible this consciousness is, and he's going to explain it not on the Vrindavan level, but on the knowledge level. A person in the divine consciousness, although engaged in seeing, hearing, touching, smelling, eating, moving about, sleeping and breathing, just like what everyone is doing, engaged in all the activities everyone engages in the world, he always knows within himself that he actually does nothing at all. Because while speaking, evacuating, receiving, or opening or closing his eyes, he always knows that only the material senses are engaged with their objects and that he is aloof from them. He's completely separate. And he's actually perceiving them. One who performs his duty without attachment, he's acting as a soul. He's perceiving himself as an eternal servant of Krishna in a body, so using his body in Krishna's service. One who performs his duty without attachment, surrendering the results unto the Supreme Lord, he's doing it for Krishna's pleasure, and the results are for Krishna. He is unaffected by sinful actions, as the lotus leaf is untouched by water. Padma patram evam vasa. As the lotus leaf is untouched by water. Na sa papena. The yogis abandoning the attachment, they act with body, mind, and intelligence, and even with their senses, but only for the purpose of purification. So they're not entangled. The senses are acting, but the mind is detached from the fruits of the action completely. That's called Nishkam Karma. Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur says. I mean, actions with no entanglement of the soul in the actions. And so here's the soul and here's the body. And they don't have anything to do with each other. So the body is acting. Why does the soul get the reactions? He's pure, he's spiritual. Why does he get the reactions from the body activities? One time, Zagatini and I were in Hong Kong. We were on the fourth floor of the Hong Kong Hilton, and we were speaking to there was a big company of very wealthy people, and we were speaking to the younger brother, Indian family, and he was smoking a cigarette. And I said, why are you smoking a cigarette? He said, I'm not smoking, it's my body who's smoking. So that's, of course, misuse of knowledge. It's not real knowledge, it's just being clever. But what is it that makes the soul experience the reactions, because the soul has nothing to do with the body, of the bodily activities? What is it that makes the soul, which is spiritual, of a different substance, experience the reactions of what the body does? But what is the medium through which the soul identifies with the body? There's something.
You can understand it. There is an example of a car errand driver. Yet if you are going to drive in a reckless way, the body is going to hurt. So the body of the person is same like soul, and the car is like.
But okay, well, they take the soul, the driver and the car. If the driver is just there, and he's in his car, and someone bangs into the car and puts a big dent in his new Mercedes, new blue Mercedes, and he gets so, I feel so much pain, but it actually didn't touch him at all. But what causes him to experience the reactions to what happens with his body? And what is the, yes? Yeah, but what is the part that, what is the intermediate between the mind, yes. The mind, it's the mind's attachment to the car. He's thinking, this is my car. And I'm going to enjoy it. And if it happens to be your car, and someone bangs into it, I feel no pain at all. Sorry, but it's true. I mean, a little bit. Okay, I have to make believe. I'm, you know, otherwise, after all, he's my friend, you know. Oh, really, too bad. I'm so sorry. But it's the mind projecting the sense of self on something that actually isn't him. That is done by the function of the mind, of the false ego, the subtle body, the false ego. And then the intelligence makes all the plans how to do everything with these ingredients. So this is the subtle body, it's the subtle body, the mind, that is, becomes attached to something, thinking it's going to enjoy it. That's where the problem lies. And if one is detached, one is like this, no connection. If one's attachment is to Krishna, thinking not on my body, and I'm going to enjoy my body, and I can't wait till I do this, and I'm going to use my intelligence in this way, and I'm going to amass this, and get that, and learn this, and I'll really enjoy it, and then I'll be able to get more, and I'm going to really, it's that spirit. The mind's attachment and its enjoying spirit that connects the soul to the body and causes the soul to experience the sufferings that come as reaction and the pleasures, because it wants to experience the pleasures. The mind wants the pleasures, so you have to get both sides. So it's that, it sits in the mind and the false ego. It's true, isn't it? Did you ever ride in? Did your, some of your friends in Delhi have really good cars?
Yes.
And some of them, if they get hit,
yes, they get hit.
In Delhi, you cannot find one car that does not get a smash, right? It's true. It's not possible because there's so many cars and they have their own special way of driving also. It's true, there's not one car that doesn't get, that doesn't have a ping, ding, and ding. But if your friend's car gets it, you don't actually experience it in the same way that he does. Right? Because there's no sense of this isn't mine. So it's the same thing when, because of our sense that this body is mine for my pleasure, especially when it's new. You really like it. It's so attached to it. You get something new and there's so much attachment because you want to keep it new forever, like in India they keep the wrapping on. Even in Vrindavan, they keep, when you buy eyeglass, chasma, they keep the little, when it says sticker or price on it, they'll keep it on there for a long time. Did you ever notice that, Dekri? Huh? And on the suitcase.
On the mattress.
And they keep it on there, just so keep it new, so I can enjoy longer. But the glasses is another thing, because it stops you from seeing, but they still keep the sticker on there. And that one's really hard to understand. They don't do that in Delhi, do they? On the sunglasses. Now the truth comes out. Yes, it's Ray-Ban.
I am Ray-Ban.
As if I'm any different.
That's the price, right? That's so everyone knows that.
You paid a high price because you're best quality. But when you think about it from the spiritual point of view, it's crazy. It's crazy, just crazy. Because you want, if no one knows that you paid a high price, or if everyone knows, you still have the same quality of glasses on, yes? So the pleasure you want is that everyone to know how wonderful you are, but you're still the same fool you always are, or the same great person, but you want everyone to know how wonderful you are. It's from when you look at it from a simple point of logical point of view, it's total puzzle. Yes or no? But still we all act this way because the mind makes us act like fools and false ego. And get entangled in the result. There's one young man, not from Delhi that I know, he's from Gujarat. And he became a devotee in Australia. And he went home, and his parents just found out he was a devotee. And he was so upset. They were so upset. He was actually living in the Brahmacharya ashram. And they were so upset. Now, I want to know why was his mother crying? And I want to see if you actually understand the psychology. Why was his mother crying and crying and crying? Why was his father so upset?
They are never going to be granted.
But even before that, but more than that, what were they really upset about?
Oh.
Huh?
Old age.
No.
They sent him to Australia. To
be poor, my make more money, yeah. But what were they really upset about? Why were they really
enjoying money?
Yeah, but what were they really upset about? That what will my friends say? What will my relatives say? Yes or no?
Yes.
Such an embarrassment. What will we tell them? We were saying, where is your son? Oh, mine is Australia. And then they find out. That doesn't work. Because everyone is thinking then, how much he's making. Yes?
Yeah.
And then, this is really what, actually they were crying about this. I mean, my parents were the same, so I'm not to criticize anyone else's parents. It's funny, except that it's
true.
It's funny, but not in the sense that makes us laugh.
because there's no pleasure in it, because there's no love in that. What is best for you isn't the consideration. It's just because you're there for me. So it's, so that is not love, that is selfishness again.
Mm-hmm.
So Krishna is talking about something completely on a, such a different level that we practically can't even, it takes us a long time to understand actually what he means. That the soul has no connection with this world. Rather, the soul has a connection with him. An eternal connection. And if we live in that connection, not try to enjoy the material world through the mind or the false ego, that is our real life. But it's so different from the way we experience reality. But this is what he's saying. That's why he's saying that when the embodied living being controls his nature and mentally renounces all actions, he resides happily in the city of the nine gates, the material body. He neither works, neither working nor causing work to be done. He's completely aloof. This is actual self-realization, where one doesn't identify himself, who he is, with the body or the mind. He identifies it with his eternal relationship with Krishna. Here will be the first paragraph of Prabhupada's purport. The embodied soul lives in the city of nine gates. The activities of the body, or the figurative city of the body, are conducted automatically by its particular modes of nature. The soul, although subjecting himself to the conditions of the body, can be beyond those conditions if he so desires. It's quite amazing if you think about it. He can be beyond the conditions of the body if he so desires. He can be beyond those conditions. That means that when the body gets sick, he doesn't have to be sick. When the body gets old, he doesn't have to be old. And when the body dies, he doesn't have to die. But not by the power of his intelligence, he can't do this. By the power of his spiritual realization, he cannot try to do it. Yes, I theoretically understand this, therefore I'm not going to get sick when I'm sick. When my tooth aches, I'm not going to be in pain. The soul, although subjecting himself to the conditions of the body, can be beyond those conditions if he so desires. Owing only to forgetfulness of his superior nature, he identifies with the material body and therefore he suffers. So we try to enjoy the material body, but the result is suffering. Therefore, when one takes the Krishna, by Krishna consciousness, he can revive means awaken his real position, his eternal position, and thus come out of his embodiment. Therefore, when one takes the Krishna consciousness, at once he becomes completely aloof from bodily activities. In such a controlled life in which his deliberations are changed, the way he makes his decisions are changed completely, very heavy. He lives happily within the city of nine gates. So if we keep on working and thinking the way we work and think, usually thinking ourselves as the body and trying to enjoy, we end up not getting what we want at all. We end up getting repeated birth and death.
Mm-hmm.
It works. He works, but he gets no reactions because he's not trying to enjoy. And then we'll read one more. No, stop. Stop, and 14, 15 are important. No, we'll read them. The embodied spirit, master of the city of his body, does not create activities. nor does he induce people to act, nor does he create the fruits of action. All this is enacted by the modes of material nature. So the body is moving all, not by this quality of person. He's not doing it. It's all going on by the modes of nature. Nor does the Supreme Lord assume anyone's sinful or pious activities. Embodied beings, however, are bewildered because of the ignorance which covers their real knowledge. We'll read from Prabhupada's purport there, a little bit down from the beginning. A living entity is by superior nature full of knowledge. Nevertheless, he is prone to be influenced by ignorance due to his limited power. The Lord is omnipotent, but the living entity is not. The Lord is vibhu, or omniscient, but the living entity is anu, or atomic. Because he is a living soul, he has the capacity to desire by his free will. Such desire is fulfilled only by the omnipotent Lord, all-powerful Lord. And so when the living entity is bewildered in his desires, the Lord allows him to fulfill those desires. But the Lord is never responsible for the actions and reactions of the particular situation which may be desired. Because he's giving us what we want according to what we deserve, so he's not responsible. Being in a bewildered condition, therefore, the embodied soul identifies himself with the circumstantial material body and becomes subjected to the temporary misery and happiness of life. The Lord is the constant companion of the living entity as Paramatma, or the Supersoul, and therefore he can understand the desires of the individual soul, as one can smell the flavor of a flower by being near it. Desire is a subtle form of conditioning for the living entity. The Lord fulfills his desires as he deserves, as the living entity deserves. Man proposes and God disposes. The individual is not, therefore, omnipotent, all-powerful in fulfilling his own desires. The Lord, however, can fulfill all desires, and the Lord, being neutral to everyone, does not interfere with the desires of the minute, independent living entities. However, when one desires Krishna, the Lord takes special care and encourages one to desire in such a way that one can attain to him and be eternally happy. Wow, what a powerful purport. So we need to change on the level of desires. And then Krishna takes special care. Otherwise, he says, whatever you want according to what you deserve it here. What do you want? You want to make some money? Okay. You want this? Okay. You want that? Okay. If you deserve it. You act piously, you'll get it. Whatever you want. But if one wants him to serve him, if one's desire is sincerely like that, Krishna will take special care. He will increase that desire in such a way that you will attain him, Prabhupada says, and be eternally happy. So, next Monday we'll read 16. Willing. Any questions or comments? How was your chanting today? What does good chanting mean to you?
Well,
what's the difference between good chanting and bad chanting for you?
At the moment, if I can hear the word, it's good. My mind is very disturbed.
Yeah, so now.
For the past couple of weeks, it's been more steady, so.
Oh, nice.
Better.
Oh, nice. And you?
My
define what's good?
How do you define good?
It's like me calling Krishna completely, you know.
Yeah, that's how you're chanting it?
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
Really? If I call him nicely, then it's good.
And you, how is your chanting?
It's not good. Mainly because I am chanting on the way. He needs to travel, you know.
Oh, on the bus or the train or something.
So it's not that good.
Are you satisfied chanting not good? Not so good?
No, I have to wake up a bit early and have to do the chanting.
What would you have to do to actually help you wake up earlier?
Sleep a bit earlier.
And what would you have to do to help you sleep earlier?
I have to prioritize.
Have to be a little more organized. So if your desire is that, if you actually desire to get up a little earlier and go to sleep a little earlier, then you'll get a little organized. Sounds like. Do you have some power to do that? Ability to do that?
Yes.
And how was your chanting?
Today?
Yeah.
It was okay. It's better yesterday. I woke up a bit late. Slept in an hour today. I was a bit tired. Woke up a bit late. Much use at the Brahma Mahuta, usually try to.
What will you do tomorrow?
I'll get up at the same time I got up yesterday. I'll try to.
Yeah. Good. Okay, I guess. How was school today?
Okay, it was boring.
What didn't you do in school today?
Sitting.
No, what didn't you do in school today?
I didn't do.
Yeah, what didn't you do in school today?
Yeah,
that's what you did do. Didn't pay attention. But what did you do? What didn't you do? It's a funny question, yeah? What didn't you do? Okay. What else didn't you do?
I didn't write.
What were you supposed to do?
Listen and hear from.
What were you paying attention to?
School.
You were tired?
Not really. Kind of.
Just bored?
Yeah. Feeling lazy. Got school, hard to wake up.
What time did you wake up?
7.
And what year of school are you in? Senior?
No, I'm in college.
Oh, college. Oh, you're in college. You finished high school?
Yeah.
When?
Last year.
Oh. And when is your birthday again?
3rd January.
3rd of January. And then you finish with your teenage years in this body. Then. Yeah? You won't be a teenager anymore. We should have a party. Yeah?